the people who were responsible for his killing. But now, 30 years later, he was wrong. I mean, the terrorist won. His stories were all but forgotten. We think that the Houston police didn't even translate the newspapers that he was publishing, and yet the group, the leaders of the group that were at the center of his criticism and his writing, they remain prominent members.
AC Thompson, we have 10 seconds. The information that you've gathered, is this going to cause the reopening of these murders?
You know, I have no idea. I certainly think there are new leads here. Should anyone want to follow them, there is new information.
We're going to do part two of this conversation online at democracynow.org. I want to thank A.C. Thompson and Rick Rowley for this remarkable documentary that aired on Frontline, Terror in Little Saigon. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is hiring a development director. Check our website at democracynow.org. And we have internships. Check there. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Your community radio station is having a book and record sale. Saturday, November 14th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., the annual KBOO Book and Record Sale will be at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. We'll have fabulous books and records, CDs, DVDs, classics and surprises, and treasures to discover. Again, that's the KBOO Book and Record Sale, Saturday, November 14th from 10 to 4 at Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. All proceeds go to support your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio presents Evil, Cruel Thing Attacking Humanity and Controlled by the Super Rich versus You and Me. This will be an evening on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This film and talk will take place on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland. Learn about how this huge, secret political entity, ALEC, creates legislation to keep wages low, to fill prisons. It bankrupts schools and poisons the air, land, and water. Union reps, teachers, activists, journalists, and others will join moderator and KBOO News Director Jenka Soderberg in a panel discussion on People versus ALEC. Again, that's a film and talk to learn about ALEC on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio here. Good evening, I'm David Kesters. A quick look at your weather for tonight. In Portland, we're looking at scattered showers with a low of 38. Then tomorrow, it'll be a high of 49 with a 30% chance of rain, turning into a 70% chance of rain tomorrow night with a low of 46. Coming up next on this Veterans Day is an hour-long Sojourner Truth special. This KBOO Portland program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide for openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones, Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com. Now, Sojourner Truth.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth exclusively on Pacifica Radio and its affiliate stations. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today marks Veterans Day in the United States. It is also Armistice Day, marking the end of World War I 96 years ago. Between 1914 and 1918, 16 million men and women were killed, often for scraps of land, no larger than a football field. We speak to author, activist, and theorist Selma James. She's based in London, and we're going to discuss World War I, the U.S. peace movement, and including Eugene Debs. Also, for our new feature, Behind the Prison Industrial Complex, we focus on prisoner whistleblowers, the case of the Dallas Six. We speak to Chandra Delaney, mother of Carrington Keys, an incarcerated person in Pennsylvania, about her son's fight to end prisoner abuse at a state correctional facility. Also, Frank Tamborello of Hunger Action Los Angeles joins us in studio to discuss homelessness, hunger, and the suffering of veterans on our city streets. Also, our weekly Earth Minute. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. President Obama opens 2 days of talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing on the sidelines of the APEC Summit of Asian-Pacific Nations. Ahead of those talks, Xi signaled progress on trade agreements.
We've already reached important common understandings on areas such as progress towards setting up the free trade area of the Asia-Pacific, increasing interconnectivity, and striving for innovation. We need to turn common understanding into action.
Xi's comments were translated by Al Jazeera Television. The U.S. Trade Representative said the two countries have reached agreement on eliminating tariffs on information technology products. Separately, President Obama is backing a 12-country Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which excludes China and Russia. The Free Trade Pact would involve a block of countries in the Americas, Asia, and the Pacific. Critics say the pact, known as the TPP, could gut individual countries' labor, environmental, and consumer protections. It has been negotiated in secret. China is backing an alternate trade pact. New York doctor Craig Spencer is set for release from the New York hospital where he was treated for Ebola after returning from working with patients in West Africa. Spencer's diagnosis followed trips on the subway to eat out and go bowling with friends, provoking public alarm about the possible spread of the virus in the city. No one else has come down with the disease. Mayor Bill de Blasio called Spencer a real hero and was to appear with him when he's released from Bellevue Hospital. New York City's police commissioner has announced police will begin issuing a summons rather than making a misdemeanor arrest for most people caught carrying small amounts of marijuana. Mayor Bill de Blasio welcomed the policy change.
We'll see fewer unnecessary arrests. It will be good for New York City as a whole. It will certainly be good for New Yorkers of color and particularly young people of color. There's no question about that.
The new policy does not apply to smoking marijuana in public. De Blasio warned he was not, quote, giving get-out-of-jail-free cards. People of color accounted for the large majority of last year's roughly 29,000 arrests for public display or smoking of marijuana. Kansas gay rights advocates are waiting to see whether the U.S. Supreme Court will allow same-sex couples to get marriage licenses this week. Justice Sonia Sotomayor yesterday temporarily blocked same-sex marriages in Kansas. A lower federal court had overturned the Kansas marriage ban. Kansas wants to keep enforcing the prohibition while the lawsuit is reviewed. Sonia Sotomayor directed the ACLU to respond by today. 10 Indian women died and 14 were in serious condition after botched operations at a government mass sterilization camp in a central Indian state. The chief minister of Chhattisgarh called the deaths unfortunate and a serious matter of negligence. The cause of the deaths wasn't yet clear, but officials said they were looking into several possibilities, including whether the surgical equipment was infected. Some 83 Indian women had the surgery at the camp, receiving incentive payments of $23 apiece. Health workers received a little over $3 for each woman they brought to the sterilization camp. The captain of a South Korean ferry that capsized in April was sentenced to 36 years in prison after a court found him guilty of negligence. He was acquitted of homicide, for which prosecutors had sought the death penalty. Most of the 304 people confirmed dead in the accident were school children. Family members wept and shouted in court as the verdict was announced, protesting what they said was too lenient a sentence. Video footage of the crew abandoning the vessel after instructing passengers to remain in their cabins had caused outrage and calls for harsh punishment. Only one crew member, the ship's chief engineer, was found guilty of homicide. His sentence came for not aiding two injured fellow crew members. The remaining 13 surviving crew members of the ferry were found guilty of various charges, including negligence, and handed down prison terms ranging from 5 to 20 years. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. For our new feature, Behind the Prison Industrial Complex, we focus on prisoner whistleblowers. In April of 2010, six black prisoners, Andre Jacobs, Anthony Kelly, Anthony Locke, Dwayne Peters, Derek Stanley, and Carrington, now known as the Dallas Six, blew the whistle on the torture of prisoners at the State Correctional Institution at Dallas, Pennsylvania, also known as SCI Dallas. The men took peaceful action to protest the torture, and prison authorities responded by beating the participants and then charging them with rioting. The case, which is now drawing national attention, began yesterday in Pennsylvania. The context of the Dallas Six trial includes last year's historic California prisoner hunger strike, as well as an earlier prisoner hunger strike in Georgia. In all of these protests, prisoners are drawing attention to the use of solitary confinement, and in the case of the Dallas Six, the torture that goes on behind prison walls. Our guest is Chandra Delaney, the mother of Carrington Keys, one of the Dallas Six. Chandra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Chandra, first begin by telling us some of the torture witnessed by the Dallas Six, because very important role that the Dallas Six plays are actually whistleblowers. They're prisoner whistleblowers. Chandra Delaney.
Some of the torture they witnessed and were victim to range from something small as like food deprivation up to murder. There was a lot of starvation where the guards did not give the inmates their meals. They did not let them out for their showers. They did not let them out for yard. When they do give them their food may contain foreign objects such as spit, urine, feces. My son had glass in his food. Some people said they have received metal in their food. They have witnessed coerced suicides by the guards. And this just doesn't happen, you know, every so often. It happens a lot where there's mental ill inmates, and the guards think it's a game, and they coerce these inmates into, into committing suicide. And when I say murder because a lot of prisoners have met their demise at the hands of the guards through either being suffocated by the tear gas because they sprayed so much into the cell, or by the brutal beatings that they give them. And this has happened many times in Pennsylvania as well.
Yeah. Now, Chandra, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going to be quite shocked by what you are describing. And you have an article that was published in Truth Out in which you ask the question, is this Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib, a torture chamber in some distant land? I'm quoting you, torture chamber, yes, but homegrown. This is solitary confinement in a state prison near you. Tell us then, the Dallas Six, they were victims of and they witnessed this torture. They're six black men. However, one of the prisoners who committed suicide that led in part to their peaceful protests was the suicide of a white prisoner. And then there was a Latino prisoner who was in some kind of torture chair. What is a torture chair? What happened to him? What is his name?
I think it's the prisoner's name is Isaac Sanchez, and the chair is actually called a restraint chair. And the purpose of the chair is to restrain someone that's, like, out of control. And what they do, they strap the person into the chair. They're strapped by their ankle. I mean, every part of your body is strapped into this chair, and it's very tight, and it constricts, you know, flow of blood. Now, the purpose that Isaac Sanchez was put in the chair was for to torture him and for retaliation, because he had witnessed them not giving another prisoner food for maybe 3 days in a row. And, you know, and he spoke about it. He spoke up about it. So instead of, like, you know, just doing the right thing and feeding the prisoner, they went in and took Isaac and set him in this chair. And this chair, excuse me, you're only supposed to be in this chair for like 2 hours. And they kept him in the chair, and nobody really knows the amount of time, but he said it was daytime when he went in, then then nighttime, then daytime again. So he figures it was anywhere between 16 to 30 hours that he was in this chair. And when he came out, he, you know, he was very blue, and he even said that during the time he was in there, they were coming in there beating him while he was in this chair.
Yeah, and in the Truth Out article, I'm looking at Isaac Sanchez, who was young at the time, saying he was naked and bloody after he was found. So tell us then about the peaceful protest. What did the Dallas Six actually do?
What the Dallas Six did, they, you know, once they saw what was happening to Isaac, they started protesting about that. And the guards told them, you know, you're next. So what the guys did was spontaneously cover their cell windows. Now, when you're in solitary, I don't think this happens everywhere else because, you know, a lot of people say they never heard of this. But in solitary in Pennsylvania, if you cover your cell window, the captain has to come down. And the prisoners do that. That's their only way to get the captain down, so they can complain about what the guards are doing. So they covered their windows, and when the captain came down, they asked for media, they asked for the DA's office, they asked for, like, anybody from the outside who, you know, someone independent that could come in and hear their, you know, hear their grievances about what was going on. But instead, they were brutally attacked by guards in riot gear.
And, you know, prior to this, they also had been getting information out to you and perhaps others, because there's something called abuse logs and an institutionalized cruelty report that you mention in your article in Truth Out. Tell us about those.
Okay. I work with Human Rights Coalition, and what we do is we get hundreds of letters every week from prisoners, and we keep a log of you know, all of the abuse that is reported. And the Dallas Six were instrumental in providing information to HRC between 2009 and 2010, and this information was put into a 93-page report called Institutionalized Cruelty.
Right. And Chandra Delaney, it seems as though, and from what I've read about this case, is that the retaliation, the beating of the Dallas Six, not only was a response to their outrage at the suicide of the white prisoner that was evoked by guards, pushed to it by guards, the Dallas Six say, and also being put in the restraint chair, the young man who was put in the restraint chair, but also because this report came out of institutionalized cruelty. Is that right? Did I get that right?
Yes. Once that a copy of that report was sent in to one of the inmates, one of the Dollar Six, Andre Jacobs, and any mail that comes in, it's scrutinized, and that went through security. And once it went through security, they saw all the guys' names in it. And actually, there were more people than, you know, than the Dollar Six that had submitted to the report. But they were, you know, they were the ones who, you know, ended up doing the protests. And that's a big part of the reason why, you know, the guards began their rampage against them, because that, you know, that report went out and it was also on the web and everything.
Right. So now, 4 years later, the trial of the charges of rioting against the Dallas Six was scheduled to begin yesterday in the Luzerne County Courthouse. That's in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. So tell us what happened with that, Chandra.
Yesterday, when we went in, well, first we had a press conference out there yesterday. And, you know, and we were able to get the word out in that county. We had myself, Derek Stanley, who's one of the Dollar Six, and Isaac Sanchez, the one who was in the chair. We spoke, you know, we spoke at the press conference yesterday. And we also had some of the organizations that were supporting us to speak out and, you know, let the public know why they were supporting the Dollar Six. In the courthouse, we went in there so that the young men could address the court and let them know what was going on. They're being denied since December 9th. It was court ordered that these men should be having conference calls with one another to, you know, to strategize for their, you know, for the upcoming case. They were not able to do that, so they wanted to address the court with that. And also my son, his legal documents that he has been putting together for these past 4.5 years went through two different prisons, and when it got to him at the Luzerne County Prison, stuff was missing. They had destroyed legal documents. They even have their boot prints on it. They stepped on stuff and put it back in so he would know they did it. So they wanted to address the court with that. We have a new attorney who has come on board, Mr. Michael Wiseman, and he is representing Derek Stanley at this time, but he may represent the rest of the Dollar Six if they choose to have him as their legal representation. What's going to happen, the case has been continued to February 7th to give the attorney time to prepare, but also to give the men time to strategize, and hopefully the judge said that she would make sure that the guys are able to, you know, communicate, but it's been a year and she hasn't been able to pull that off yet. So hopefully they'll be able to communicate and we'll have a trial on February 17th.
February 17th, right, 2015. Yes. Our guest is Chandra Delaney, coordinator of the Justice for the Dallas Six Support Campaign and mother of Carrington Keys, one of the Dallas Six. Chandra has been an advocate for human and civil rights for 15 years at the Human Rights Coalition and the Abolitionist Law Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So, Chandra, you've been heading up a campaign, a support effort for the Dallas Six. Tell us about that effort, who is involved in that, and what kind of response you're getting from the press and the public. Chandra Delaney.
I'm so happy I started out like as just a mom doing this, trying to get the word out, and so many people have come on to help. Global Women's Strike in Philadelphia and UK have been they have really, you know, taken on this case and really helped me to get it where it is. Also, in the past month or so, well, maybe like the past 2 months, we have received a lot of endorsements from a lot of different organizations in the Philadelphia area and some national organizations, and we have come together to begin to put something together by February 17th. It's going to be really big, and I'm really happy that, you know, for all the help and support that I have. As far as the press, I think it's going good in the national press, and we even had an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer last week, which I had to correct some information, but they did immediately put up the correction. We are hoping to get more press in the Luzerne County area where the case is actually going to take place, you know, just to get the word out, because the way we look at it, the potential jurors are coming from there. And then we have to kind of sway, because a lot of the people in that area actually, you know, it's a depressed area around there, and a lot of those people work at the prisons, and their family right. members work at the prisons. So we kind of have to, you know, get the word out and get them to realize what's really going on.
Right. And Chandra Delaney, we literally are out of time, but for our people who are listening and who would like to support your efforts in some way, the efforts of the support campaign, what should they do?
The best way to get any information about the $6 is to go to sbi6.blogspot.com. All the information is on there as far as ways you can help and any information about the case.
Could you repeat that, please?
Yes. It's sbi6.blogspot.com.
All righty. And Chandra Delaney, we are going to continue to follow this case. I'm looking at your publicity that says stop the abuse and torture of prisoners, support the Dallas Six. So Chandra Delaney, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are now going to shift our focus here. Today is Veterans Day in the United States, and it is also Armistice Day, celebrating the end of World War I 96 years ago. The war killed more than 16 million soldiers and civilians, ended centuries-old empires, and scarred a generation physically and mentally. The cause of World War I is a subject of intense debate among historians, but the start is usually attributed to the assassination of Austro-Hungarian Archduke Franz Ferdinand on July 1914 in the Bosnian city of Sarajevo. His killing triggered a cascade of mobilizations, threats, and eventually declarations of war among every major European power that eventually enveloped the globe. For 4 years, between 1914 and 1918, Europe divided itself into two rival alliances and proceeded to tear itself apart. France, the British Empire, Russia, and later the United States formed the Allies, while Germany, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire became known as the Central Powers. More than 70 million men and women from these countries would serve during the war. By the war's end, of the seven main combatant nations, three would be nearing exhaustion. Two would cease to exist entirely, and one would undergo severe social and political revolution. The war would also bring to light the ugly faces of nationalism and unbridled patriotism. Nearly every country involved, including the United States, passed draconian anti-sedition laws aimed at silencing dissenters and peace activists. One of these, Eugene V. Debs, a U.S. socialist, co-founder of the Industrial Workers of the World and five-time presidential candidate, was sentenced to 10 years after delivering a speech urging young men to resist the draft. In 1920, he ran for president from his prison cell, earning nearly a million votes as a write-in candidate and finishing third behind Democrat William Cox and the victor Republican Warren G. Harding. What we're going to do now is we're going to go to a clip from Euronews that gives a little taste of what is happening as Europe remembers Armistice Day, and they talk about some tunnels that were built in France.
The 11th day of the 11th month is Armistice. This year, the centenary of the start of World War I, French President François Hollande will oversee the inauguration of a memorial to 580,000 soldiers who lost their lives on the battlefields of northern France. The memorial at Notre-Dame de Lorette is one of several in remembrance of the fallen. But besides the countless regimental cemeteries, there are other reminders of where great battles were fought. One such place lies beneath the town of Arras in Pas-de-Calais. There, 17th-century chalk quarries were brought back into use by New Zealand soldiers. Digging 20 metres down, the troops formed connecting chambers to create a massive underground barracks. Isabel Pilarovsky is today's curator of the Wellington Tunnels. The idea was to hide 24,000 men underground so they could suddenly appear and surprise the Germans, who had no idea of the existence of the tunnels. It's a veritable 20-kilometre-long maze. For 6 months, the soldiers honed the caves, hidden in a cathedral of cold, wet chalk, waiting for the spring offensive against the Germans. You have to realize they had to go to the bathroom here, eat, wash, and even sleep. And the soldiers left traces of themselves, what they got up to in order to relieve the boredom. Our reporter in Arras says, April the 9th, 1917. It's 6:30 in the morning and 24,000 men in these tunnels will rise up out of an outlet onto the snow-covered ground. German machine guns lie ahead, but the plan worked and the Allied troops launched a surprise attack.
All righty, that was a clip from Euronews. I'd now like to welcome our guest to discuss World War One, but also the anti-war movement, and also including Eugene Debs. We'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth London-based Selma James. Selma, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Selma James, an anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-capitalist campaigner, author, and theorist. She was raised in a movement household, and she joined CLR James's Johnson Forest tendency at the age of 15. And from 1958 to 1962, she worked with him in the movement for Caribbean Federation and Independence. They did marry. She is now the widow of CLR James. In 1972, Selma James founded the International Wages for Housework campaign, and in 2000, she helped launch the Global Women's Strike, which she is the international coordinator. She coined the word unwaged to describe the caring work most women do, and it has since entered the English language to describe all the work without wages of women, children, and men in the home, on the land, and in the community. She is a founding member of the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network. Her publications include The Ladies and the Mammies, Jane Austen and Jean Rhys, The Milk of Human Kindness, and most recently, Sex, Race, and Class. And also coming up is she did the introduction of the upcoming book, Ujamaa, The Hidden Story of Tanzania's Socialist Villages, that was written by Ralph Ibbett. So a lot of experience there, Selma James. But we want to focus now on World War One. So many lives lost, and it sounds as though pretty senseless. I mean, most wars are pretty senseless, but you've got 16 million lives lost, Selma James.
Well, it was a horrendous carve up, and I was born in 1930, and it seemed like people were still getting over the war. And my mother talked about it all the time. And she said she was so hostile to it, and she told me about the songs, the anti-war songs that they sang at that time, and the fact that it was all about Emperor Franz Joseph or whatever his name was. She wasn't absolutely certain. And she said it was all about him, and she never thought that that was a reason for the war at all. In fact, she was right. It was about carving Africa up and redistributing the colonies among the imperial powers. That's what the war was, an imperialist war. That's what it was about, and that's what you don't hear when they tell you about what happened 100 years ago today.
Absolutely. And so tell us what you know then about the anti-war movement. And do you recall any of those songs? We're actually going to be playing a song later in the show from Greenfields of France. It is called. But Selma James, anything about the songs and about the anti-war movement?
Well, first of all, you could tell that there had been a movement precisely by the song. She said the song that went, "I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I raised him up to be my pride and joy. Mm. There'd be no war today if mothers all would say, 'I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier.'" And that was, you know, that was really important to her, and she used to sing it to me, and it was perfectly clear. She had not been political during the war, but she had been, as all the people around her were, hostile to this war and hostile to all the killing that had gone on. And the killing of Americans was far less, of course, than the Europeans, because the U.S. joined the war late. But it was still horrible.
Absolutely.
And also, mm-hmm. Eugene Debs was a great hero. And I don't know if your listeners know that not only did he get almost 1 million votes for being against the war and for going to prison because he was against, but he also, when he came out, was very hostile to prisons. He said he would never consider himself free until all prisoners were free. So he learned a great deal when he was inside as well.
Yes, and Selma James, as I mean, you are in Europe now. You're based in London, England, and of course it was all over the press this morning of
the
moment of silence and the fields of poppies, which the people in the U.S. won't know about the symbolism of the poppies. On this side of the pond, so to speak, it is Veterans Day here in the United States, and I'm very sad to announce that war veteran and outspoken war critic Thomas Young has died at the age of 34. And he had said how he wanted to be remembered was that, quote, "I fought as hard as I could to keep another me from coming back to Iraq." And in remembering him, we want to honor him today on this Veterans Day, Selma. When you talked about the song your mother sang, "I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier," you certainly think of people like Thomas Young and my own mother, my brother being a veteran. I'd like to remember him today. He's quite ill now as a result of having participated in the Vietnam War. Selma James, your comment about veterans on this Veterans Day.
Well, what people have to know is that most soldiers do not shoot the other side. They shoot up. The idea of killing is not natural to us at all. There are some killers trained to be, but most of us hate the thought of it, women and men, and they have found that they have really to work on men, and no doubt women too, to get them to actually shoot to kill. Our instinct is to love, and governments don't get rich on our loving each other, which is what tells us what we need to do.
Right, absolutely. Now, you mentioned just finally on Eugene Debs, anti-war activist, ran for president, yes. Got a lot of votes. A million votes were a lot of votes during that time. But also the war itself, I mean, the violence of that war, the huge anti-war movement that happened in Europe had something to do, some say, to what happened in Russia. With the toppling of the Romanov dynasty.
Yeah, it no doubt was the occasion for the Soviet Revolution. Everywhere in the world there were movements against war. It also had a lot to do with the growth of the women's movement, because women were particularly active internationally against the war, and the Soviet Revolution was a great inspiration to all kinds of people, really spurring them on and making them feel that there was a power, at least somewhere in the world, that was against war and against the exploitation that war always supported and ensured. And it's very good to read that history. They weren't like Mrs. whatever her name is going to run for president. Clinton, yes, that's the name. They were not Hillary Clintons. They were women who wanted to see the population do well, that they... all the resources of the world should be used for people to be happy rather than to slaughter each other. And I'm very glad one of the leading people in the movement against war and for women's organizing was also for women to be paid for the work that they did, so, which is my belief as well.
Right. Well, on that note, Selma James, we are going to have to leave it there. But thank you for joining us on this Veterans Day and Armistice Day. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott. And for full disclosure, I am active with the Global Women's Strike. We are going to take a station break, and coming up, our weekly Earth Minute. And Frank Tamburello with Hunger Action Los Angeles joins us in studio to talk about hunger, not only in a major city like Los Angeles, but across the nation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Walking all day, and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you are only 19 when you joined the Great Fallen in 1916. I hope you died well, and I hope you died clean. Our young Willie McBride was it slow and obscene. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did you leave a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined.
This is Ed Asner. You're listening to Fearless Drive Time Radio, Sojourner Truth with host Margaret Prescott.
And that's Green Fields of France. The artist is Eric Bogle, as we honor really the 16 million lives lost in World War I. Today is Armistice Day. It is also Veterans Day in the United States, and we would like to remember all of the veterans across the U.S., but indeed around the world. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We'd like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners. Please check us out at www.sojournertruth.com. SoTrueRadio.org, our website, and you can like and friend us on Facebook. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. We are now going to go to our weekly Earth Minute, and then coming up, Frank Tamburello of Hunger Action Los Angeles joins us in studio.
Scientists in Syracuse, New York, recently released a new study promoting a genetically engineered American chestnut tree. They plan to plant this blight-resistant GE tree to restore American chestnuts to eastern forests. A closer look at their study reveals disturbing information. The scientists teamed up with ArborGen, a GE tree development company jointly owned by timber giants International Paper and MeadWestvaco. ArborGen is currently seeking approval to sell billions of non-native invasive GE eucalyptus trees for plantations that will have a devastating impact on forests across the southern U.S. Why would scientists concerned about forests do this? Is the GE American chestnut really just a Trojan horse designed to fool people into thinking that GE trees are okay? Can the forests of the eastern U.S. be restored using an unproven and dangerously unstable GE tree that can live for centuries and spread pollen and seeds for miles? It is irresponsible to risk unknown, unknowable, and irreversible impacts of GE trees on a forest ecosystem in the name of conservation. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
And that was our weekly Earth Minute. I would now like to welcome in studio Frank Tamburello. He is with Hunger Action Los Angeles. And we know that hunger, of course, a growing, unfortunately, sadly, a growing problem, not only in a major urban area like Southern California, but frankly, across the world. Frank Tamburello, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Frank Tamburello, I'm looking at some data here that says on a single night in January 2013, 610,000 people were experiencing homelessness, and that's a nationwide trend. There are some states that are seeing a decrease in homelessness, but we know that it is a continued problem, and particularly when the weather gets really starts getting cold in Southern California, but also on the East Coast. Frank, tell us some of what you're attempting to deal with.
Well, you know, since it's Veterans Day, I thought I'd talk a little bit about homeless vets. And so, you know, I think you talked about a single night count of 600,000 homeless people. And the Veterans Affairs did a single night count a couple years ago, and they estimated between 48,000 and 49,000 homeless vets.
Wow.
So we're looking just at vets. But that's believed to be an undercount by a lot of people. And so it's estimated as actually up to 100,000. And there's just some striking facts about that that we may not usually consider. About 10,000 of those are female vets. Mm. And a lot of female veterans deal with problems of, they're a lot of them are single parents, divorced. Mm-hmm. So they're raising kids also in homelessness. And in addition to the 100,000 likely homeless vets, there's about 1.4 million at risk. And we may have a stereotype from movies and TV of the homeless Vietnam veteran. Mm-hmm. But thousands, like tens of thousands, are veterans of the most recent conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And again, there's a lot more at risk, probably about 38,000 at risk of homelessness from those conflicts. So there's been a lot of push nationally to fund programs for homeless vets. But even there has just had to be some really strong advocacy. For example, the VA had cut off a lot of people from benefits if they had a less than honorable discharge or if they had served for fewer than 24 months. And there was a strong enough outcry earlier this spring that the VA restored some of the funding for those programs. But when you hear things like that, you have to explore why was there so much homelessness among people with a less than honorable discharge? What was the discharge for? We look into it and you find a lot of it is related to substance abuse. Mm. Which is related to post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's just another example of how war creates people who are permanent victims. Like someone was talking about people being taught to kill. Many, I think up to a third of the veterans who are in state prisons now are there for violent offenses. So where is that violence learned? Where does that come from? Why do people have to turn to substance abuse? This is how war sort of makes a permanent victim of people who are forced to participate in it.
Yeah, and domestic abuse showing up. You know, what you say about, because there really is a hidden face of the homeless. I mean, there is the stereotype of, you know, somebody who is a substance abuser with a tin cup, you know, standing on the corner to, you know, get some coins so that they could go and get the next drink. I was talking with our sister Judy Vaughn recently from Alexandria House, and she was saying that the new studio apartment for single mothers is a car.
That's right. And there's a lot of homelessness among students, too, and hunger especially. In my course of working around the issue of hunger, I'm asked to speak at some of the local colleges and universities. And at every single occasion, a student has asked me about some of the very restrictive rules, for example, about students getting SNAP or what used to be known as food stamps. And then I would find out later that the reason the student asked that is because they were in sore need of food. And we had calls from some local community colleges asking what could be done because they were faced with so many students who couldn't make ends meet. They either couldn't pay their rent, they didn't have enough money for food, just a wide variety of situations. And so it's carryover from this most recent recession that has squeezed a lot of people who were middle class for the first time into confronting survival poverty.
Right. I mean, it just breaks my heart listening to what you're saying, Frank, because as you talked about these college students, I'm reminded when I started out as a young teacher in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, Brooklyn, in New York City, and realizing that my students, these were first through third grade, that they were hungry, and then worked with the Black Panther Party to bring in the free breakfast program into our school at PS 155 in Brooklyn. And it made such a huge difference. And to think now that perhaps some kind of food program may be needed on the college level, because now you've got college students.
And a lot of it really should just be tweaking of the current rules of the SNAP program.
Yeah.
This is what happens with government programs, is that since you have one faction that doesn't even want them to exist, essentially, you know, very conservative people don't think we should have any sort of welfare program at all. They spend a lot of effort legislatively to make it hard to get these programs. So there's like an iron-walled bureaucracy that has to be overcome. And that's what's happened with SNAP, among with many other programs.
Yeah, well, Frank, I'm so honored that you were able to come into studio. I know we've worked, you know, on various things together, fighting poverty. And most recently, the Stop the War and the Poor event held over in MacArthur Park this past summer. But also, you know, I'll have to say, I was a bit taken aback by the honor that Hunger Action LA, they're actually going to be giving me an award. I don't know how deserving I am of that award.
Well, I think you're very, very deserving
at
for
this
everything
event.
You've done over the years.
Well, yeah. At an event that's coming up. But the important thing about that event is not particularly that award, but the fact that programs like yours, and I want you to talk a little bit about some of the programs you do, but it is a fundraiser as well. And I know on this show here at KPFK, we have tried our best to do some fundraising to help with those efforts, because we know that the funding is very difficult to come by. So first off, just tell our listeners about this event, and for people who might want to get tickets, or if they can't get tickets, who might want to make a donation to it in the name of this show or in the name of a loved one or someone, what should they do? Tell us about
this. So if you're in Los Angeles, or even if you want to fly out here and drop in,
right,
just go to hungeractionla.org and you can find the information about the event, which is this Thursday. And I should talk a little about some of the kinds of folks we're honoring.
Yeah.
They're working in a broader sphere, really, than hunger to a large extent. It's the access to fresh, affordable, healthy food. Mm-hmm. So we have Rick Namias from Food Forward. They're out collecting fruit from trees that would otherwise go to waste. We have the Revolutionary Autonomous Communities are being honored. They serve fresh fruits and vegetables here at MacArthur Park.
Yeah, an amazing program every Sunday for years now.
And all volunteer on top of that. And then there's our own Market Match program, which is for people who are low income, they're getting SNAP or food stamps or SSI or the WIC program. We're able to match them. The money they spend. If they spend $5, we can give them an extra $5 for fruits and vegetables. If they spend $10, we give them an extra $10. And it's been a fantastically successful program here, and there's programs like it around the country. There's one, in fact, called Veggie Prescriptions up in Massachusetts, where doctors are working with people who have diabetes, obesity, and they prescribe them like literally $40 to $50 of fruits and vegetables a month and give them the money to go buy it.
What a great idea.
Yeah, and start changing changing their diet, changing their life, and they have, you know, proven results from this.
So instead of getting a prescription for a drug from Big Pharma, you give a prescription so people can go get some healthy food.
Good food. It's food is medicine. And there is an ironic connection to World War I in that. During World War I, the British were blockading Germany. Germany was a country that had become so big it wasn't supplying all its own food. And the British were blockading Germany, and starvation started to set in. It got to the point where to get fruits or vegetables in Germany, you had to have a prescription from a doctor. And so there's kind of a strange irony in going back to, you know, deprivation of food being used as a weapon of war.
Yeah.
Your earlier guest talked about it being used in prison, you know, to control people, all the way now to people being prescribed fresh food because it's just very difficult to get and very difficult to afford.
Right. And of course, for the event coming up, tickets are still available.
Oh, yeah. 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 We will make room for you.
Yeah.
If there's no tickets,
we'll
squeeze you
under the
door.
What's the cost of the
ticket? It's $85. And you can just go to hungeractionla.org and find out more about the event and the tickets, and it's just a really wide array of other folks being honored. There's are some people working on international issues as well. Fair Trade LA, which is an up and coming network that's working on you know, economic justice in other countries.
That's right. And so for our listeners in Southern California who are able to come or support in some way, and also for listeners in other parts of the country, there are sponsors for this event, and for people, there are title sponsors for people at a higher end who are able to donate $10,000. There's a harvest sponsor for people who are able to donate $5,000, the growth sponsor $3,000, and seed sponsor at $1,000. But also people could actually donate at any level. How important is this kind of fundraising for the programs that you all are doing day in and day out?
For this program, it's really critical right now. This program has a lot of momentum. We served over 10,000 people during the course of the year, and a large number of those were during the summer due to a
10,000 people?
Yes,
wow.
Due to a promotion we did together with the WIC program. And just to show you how much in demand fresh fruits and vegetables are, when we were offering just this modest bonus, for example, the farmers market in East Hollywood, one of the places we were offering the program, people drove all the way from Orange County, you know, 40, 50 miles.
Wow.
I know you have listeners in other parts of the country for whom this geographical references don't make sense, but imagine driving 40 or 50 miles because that's how far you had to go to get the kind of healthy food that you want to feed your family. So we're keeping the momentum up on this, but, you know, we're also an advocacy and policy group. And so we're not intending for this to just be an ongoing program that we're going to have to scrape around for, but that it become institutionalized as part of our hunger safety net in the country, that people can have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, which also support local California farmers and support our local economy.
Right. And very quickly, for people who want to make a donation to your effort, or including getting tickets, what should they do?
Best thing is just to go to hungeractionla.org. There you can make the donation or get the ticket or both. And we'd love to see you. And again, this is just there's no event like this in Southern California. Every time we've done this dinner, people say they just met so many people they had no idea were doing this kind of work.
That's right. Well, I certainly intend to make a donation towards the success of this fundraiser. And Frank, also very quickly, because we literally have 30 seconds, there's also a little booklet that you all put out helpful.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this booklet well predates my arrival in Los Angeles. So I inherited it from a group of pioneering advocates who are forever going to be in the pantheon of LA advocacy. So it's about how to access programs if you're unemployed, if you need food assistance, if you need health care, housing. It's called The People's Guide to Welfare, Health, and Other Services.
It's fantastic.
Yes, yeah. And the new edition is coming out in a couple of weeks.
All righty. Well, Frank Tamburello, thank you so much for all of your efforts. Thank
Thanks
you for
very
joining
much, Mark.
Us. Yeah, we are literally out of time. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Sherelle Withers, our engineer, Teddy Robinson, assistant producer, Kevin Walker. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank all of today's guests. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland, K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM, and K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM. Up next is Right to Survive Radio, but first we have some important messages just for you.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Pollinating Rios Vivos, Thursday, November 12th.